Hello, and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 23rd, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on water. Then we'll move on to articles from Valley and State News, and then on to national and world news with articles from USA Today. Our feature front page article for this Sunday is entitled, A Shrinking Supply. The subtitle is, Tribes Watch the Water Flow Away. This is by Brandon Loomis. Along the Green River tailwater section below Flaming Gorge Dam in April, Utah angler Christopher Schott was casting flies and reeling in rainbow trout. He knew the river would swell in the coming weeks as reclamation moved water to raise Lake Powell, but he said he didn't expect that it would hurt the fishing much, not for long. It's probably not the worst idea, the Layton resident said. Flaming Gorge is 436 feet deep, right? There's probably some to spare, but I don't know if it's a long-term solution. You've got to get water from somewhere, said Doug Harding, Schott's fishing buddy. After winding through the deep red canyon that led river explorer John Wesley Powell to name the place Flaming Gorge, the swollen green flows south past the fossil boneyards at Dinosaur National Monument and then through the Uinta and Ouray Indian Reservation. There, the farmers and ranchers of the roughly 2,000-member Northern Utes can only watch some of what's rightfully their water pass them by, as it has for long decades. We're not going to see the proportion that should be ours, said Laura J. Arochis Ivy, a 66-year-old Ute rancher who proudly introduces herself as a cattle baroness. Her family runs a reservation-leading herd of 250 head. In fact, though a river swollen with emergency flows for Lake Powell will lap at their land through the summer, seeing that water is all the Utes will be able to do with it. They're entitled by legal settlement to more than 29,000 acre-feet a year from the green, but they lack the pipes and pumps it would take to move it west to where it's needed. It's not wet water, but rather a paper right as dry as some of the tribe's hayfields in this drought year. We don't have any say, Arochis Ivy said, of the federal order pulling water, some of it rightfully her tribe's water, out of Flaming Gorge to protect Powell. They're just going to do it. The Utes must also watch what might have been their water flow west from the reservation and clean out of the Colorado River watershed. Snowpack from the Uinta Mountains should naturally melt and flow through smaller tributaries toward the Green and ultimately the Colorado. Instead, it fills a series of Utah reservoirs, part of a Central Utah project's 101,000-acre-foot diversion, before making its way through a tunnel to the state's urban corridor in the eastern Great Basin. The Utes agreed to this diversion, Tribal Water Rights Director Shane Hamblin said, with the understanding that the federal government would later build reservoirs to store water locally for Ute irrigators. A series of disputes over the size and purpose of those projects ended with the tribe getting settlement funds for other resource projects instead, but never the reservoirs to hold its snowmelt until the hot months when it's most needed. The result is that, in a crushing drought year like this one, ranchers like Arochis Ivy will have to pay top dollar for scarce hay or sell off cattle to get through summer. And again, much of their water will have flowed downstream and into the Green on its way to Powell. A lot of that water was already off and away in late April. A March heat wave with highs in the 80s had melted off the Uinta Range slopes on the northern horizon, and what little snow was visible there a month later had arrived as a recent dusting. Arochis Ivy and family had turned on the hayfield sprinklers early in the month, earlier than they would normally like, given persistent morning frost damaging the new growth. But they had to take what they could while it was flowing down the Uinta River. If we don't use it, she said, we lose it. Ute farmers on the reservation are supposed to enjoy a right to spread 3 acre feet a year on each acre they irrigate, and that decree has a solid 1861 priority, predating Glen Canyon Dam construction by a century and far outranking many of its downstream dependents. Without a reservoir to hold it back, though, most of the Uinta River's flow is gone before most of those farmers can use it at all. Before the megadrought struck the Colorado River Basin around 2000, Erichis Ivy said, she averaged 3 alfalfa cuttings a year. Since then, she has only been able to grow 2 in most years. Last year, she got 1.5, a dearth she thought might be eclipsed this year. Her father, Frank, recalled fighting all his life to get and use the water that was rightfully his. It required knowing and asserting his rights to tribal, federal, and state officials who sought to cut him off so others could use the water. Looking up at the thin snowpack glinting off the Uintas, he said he hoped future generations would continue to protect their claim to that source. The old man, now 90, helped celebrate global understanding when the Winter Olympics came to Utah in 2002. Dressed in Ute regalia, including feathered headdress, he had welcomed the Olympic torch to the state and blessed it for the relay that would take it to Salt Lake City. Today, he hopes a similar spirit of cooperation can end the competition for water. "We can only get the amount of water that comes down the river," he said. "If we're going to survive, we have to learn how to share." Fighting for our own water. The Northern Utes' experience mirrors that of other tribes who theoretically enjoy high priority rights to Colorado River water, but lack the practical ability to use that water. Any deal between the states and the feds to balance supply and demand and halt the reservoir slide should start with a plan to help tribes access their water, said Daryl Vigil, a member of the Jicarilla Apache tribe in New Mexico, who co-chairs the Water and Tribes Initiative, a coalition that seeks to help tribes manage their water and participate in the Colorado River's broader solutions. The need is especially acute for Native communities who lack ready access to clean drinking water, he said. And yet the river negotiators from the 7 states don't center this in their debates. "It's not happening in indigenous country," Vigil said. "Most of the country has that because they had the resources and the political will and they built it," he said. Some tribal governments, such as Central Arizona's Gila River Indian Community, and Western Arizona's Colorado River Indian tribes, have both ready access and authorization to either use or lease their water. But many of the watershed's 30 tribes have neither. "It's a problem that Congress could address, at least for the Navajos, Hopis, and San Juan Southern Paiutes, through a proposed Northeastern Arizona Indian Water Rights Settlement Agreement that has stalled while the states bicker over the shrinking river. The settlement would both provide funds to develop on-reservation projects and allow the Navajos and Hopis to recoup operating funds by leasing some of their water to other users, perhaps in Phoenix or Tucson, through the Central Arizona Project Canal. That latter provision causes trepidation in the Upper Basin because it would mean allowing the Navajos to market their Upper Basin water to the Lower Basin, a precedent that some fear could lead to others doing the same and dry up farms in Wyoming, Colorado, or Utah for the benefit of Arizona or California. Bessie Yazzie is among those waiting. When it comes to water for her rural Navajo home, she has been waiting since before some Americans who now collect Social Security were born. That's how long it's been since she learned that the flowing waters of her youth would rise behind Glen Canyon Dam and force her family from its home in Navajo Canyon. In her childhood, she said, her family grew watermelons, grapes, pumpkins, and other foods in the canyon that Lake Powell would later flood. They had ready access to stream water there, and they grew what they needed or could trade because they were far from stores. Then, in 1956, Congress authorized the 710-foot-tall concrete dam, a project that would take 7 more years to finish. "My dad told me, the water's going to come this way," said Yazzie, now 86. So where are we going to live? Where are we going to go? There was no place safe within the canyon, so they settled above its cliffs on a peaceful plain near a bluff called Lechi Rock, high and dry. That's where Yazzie and two dogs remain with a small sheep herd that numbered 28 this spring. She worked for decades at the lodge catering to boaters and tourists at Lake Powell's Waweep Marina, but now draws her own retirement benefits and enjoys the solitude when not driving off to Page for water. That errand generally takes 60 to 90 minutes. The tribal government told her family decades ago that a water line would soon come their way, she said. It's still the same, Yazzie said. It's still nothing. Getting water to all Navajo homes, dispersed as they are down dirt roads across 27,000 square miles, could be a stretch at any imaginable level of government spending. But pipelines could bring water filling stations much closer to thousands who must haul drinking water for themselves or their sheep across vast badlands, some of them for hours. And getting a line to Yazzie's road, near as it is to Page and the reservoir, could be manageable with settlement funds. That's what Renee Sozi, who manages the Lechi chapter of the Navajo government, said should happen, and soon. We're fighting for our own water, Sozi said. The water that we were allowed to just use and graze and provide for our families in that way, like in Yazzie's day, it was right there. It was accessible. Nobody put restraints up. You can have a cup today or you can have a cup tomorrow. Yazzie and others have waited a lifetime, Sozi said. They have long deserved the sort of access that the federal government paid to deliver great distances to Phoenix or Los Angeles, she said. Now we're the younger generation, still trying to say the same thing, but nobody listens. Yazzie's nephew Elmer, a Phoenix iron worker who grew up just down the road from her, was staying with her in April to help with shearing and other chores. One was to drive her flatbed Chevy with a rusty bed and 325-gallon plastic tank into Page to fill up at a water standpipe next to a gas station and car wash. It's a truck that his late father had bought used, he said, so there's no telling whether the odometer reading of 150,000 miles was accurate. The water would cost a few bucks, but the truck's emptying gas tank would limit him to one trip for the week. Normally, the sheep will drink two full deliveries in a week during warmer months, he said, but there would be no gas money until his aunt's next retirement payment arrived. In seeking settlements to define their water rights, tribes like the Navajos are seeking the same opportunities as other tribes who have gained authorization not just to move and use river water, but to market it to others. The Colorado River Indian Tribes, CRIT, consisting of several indigenous ancestries on a single western Arizona reservation, for instance, hold substantial senior water rights and have congressional authorization to lease some of it off-reservation. That could make CRIT a major player in helping neighbors around the lower basin adapt to shortage. But the tribal council has bestowed personhood status on the Colorado to ensure it remains a living river, a lawyer for the tribes noted at the University of Colorado's River Conference, and buying CRIT water would also mean paying the river. Leases could fund a share of water dedicated to the river itself, for example, or for delivery to associated wetlands. A living Colorado River with a functioning ecosystem is as important to our existence as the air we breathe, tribal chairwoman Amelia Flores said. In the canyon, wilderness reborn. At least one zone on the river is returning to life, ironically because of drought and overuse. Glen Canyon, the labyrinth of river and side canyons that drowned when the dam backed up flat water for 186 miles, is now reemerging from under Lake Powell. The Glen Canyon Institute invited conservationists, policy advocates, and journalists for a boating and hiking trip in April to see how merely resurfacing tributary canyons has restored them to some of the Colorado's lushest and least disturbed natural areas. GCI Executive Director Eric Balkin led the group on a hike up Davis Gulch through watercress mats that hid frogs and past steep willow thickets and fields of tall grass, a green carpet in the canyon bottom contrasting with the orange and beige sandstone cliffs, beaver dams impounded ponds along the shallow stream beneath towering arches. At one point, approaching Lake Powell's old high-water mark, the inches-deep stream narrowed into successive incisions it had carved in the bedrock and plunged into a deep pool ringed by a hanging garden of native vines. All of it had been submerged for decades after the dam's completion and the reservoir's filling in the 20th century. Now this finger of the lake's Escalante River arm is back above water and largely shielded from human impacts other than the footprints of the occasional hikers who go out of their way to find places that Lake Powell and the cliffs have walled off from car access. "This is beautiful," said David Wegner, a GCI board member and former Bureau of Reclamation scientist. He had monitored changing conditions when Lake Powell was filling and later led the government's Glen Canyon Environmental Studies Program that documented the dam's impacts. "You cannot look at this place and not say, wow," Wegner said. "I've traveled all over the world and there's no place like this." In the 1980s, with Davis Gulch and dozens of other side canyons containing natural bridges and primeval waterfalls sunken into oblivion, Wegner thought Americans had seen the last of these features. The fabled wilderness would be remembered only in the words of the lake's namesake explorer geologist John Wesley Powell or pre-dam river runners like Katie Lee or Ken Slight. "One of my first jobs working for the Bureau of Reclamation was to evaluate filling this place," Wegner said. "It wasn't imagining what it would look like drained." "Could I have imagined it?" he said. "No, but I'm really happy I'm seeing it. What an opportunity as a human being and as a scientist to see the changes that are going on." The tour also stopped at a site long revered by the river running community, but only in recent years returned fully above water, Cathedral in the Desert. That secluded alcove shelters a tall ribbon of water plunging over a sandstone shelf into a pool. A steep sandbank descends to meet the pool from one side, and a hanging garden clings to the stone wall on the other. It's a place where river runners once camped and sang, and where more recent visitors plied houseboats right up to the falls when Powell's water largely inundated it. Lovers and others have scrawled graffiti on the canyon wall. Slight, an old-time river runner and canyon outfitter, has despised the Glen Canyon Dam ever since it blocked the river and flooded his stomping grounds, including Cathedral. He was the inspiration for one of the protagonists in author Edward Abbey's novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, about a group of wilderness-loving saboteurs who dream of blowing up the dam. As the dam's 50th anniversary approached in 2013, Slight invoked the location as a reason to hate the reservoir that he called Lake Fowl. "They destroyed Cathedral in the Desert," he told the Republic at that time. Lee, a folk singer and pioneering boatwoman who died in 2017, revisited Cathedral as the waterfall started to reemerge, but was unimpressed as reservoir water still lapped at the grotto. The poor, bleached-out hollow was water-filled to 50 feet above its original floor and devoid of the inexplicable aura once swirling beneath the dome, she wrote in the afterword for her book, Glen Canyon Betrayed. Its ghosts, long since departed, had taken with them their vivid shawls, sandals, and necklaces, along with bracelets, perfumed wreaths, and wallflowers that made a live Cathedral in the Desert pulse and breathe with the flicker of sun on a ribbon of flowing water. Had Lee lived to see Cathedral as it is today, fully drained and requiring a short trek from a boat, she might still despair, as she wrote of missing countless more cathedrals, amphitheaters, shrines, cloisters, and other hallowed retreats buried deeper along the Colorado's main channel through Glen Canyon. And in April, a faint scent hinted at decaying quagga mussels, invasive shellfish that spread through the reservoir and now hang from its dried-up sides. but the alcove was a pleasant enough setting that some tour participants lay motionless on the sandbank and stared up at the waterfall or closed their eyes to absorb its audible whoosh and spatter. "It's beautiful," said Vigil, the Indigenous water rights advocate with the Water and Tribes Initiative, who was among those enjoying the scene. He had heard from others who recalled and missed houseboating there and said he didn't mean to dismiss their experience, though we have different values. "I honor their emotions about it," he said, "but many people will never fondly remember jumping off a houseboat into Cathedral." He would prefer this part of the river as it was. Since climate change and the Southwest thirst have drained some two-thirds of the water out of America's two largest artificial reservoirs, Powell and Mead, he wouldn't mind seeing what's left of Powell let loose to run down Grand Canyon and backfill Mead at the other end. "I'm a proponent of no dam," Vigil said. That's akin to Balkans and GCI's fill Mead first position, though political realities make removal a hard sell when the government invested hundreds of millions of dollars, around $3 billion when adjusted for inflation, in the dam and power plants, not to mention maintenance costs. The group instead advocates plumbing tunnels around the dam at river level to allow continuous flow or even full drainage down the river channel if the reservoir keeps sinking. "Reclamation should have been planning for this eventually for years," Balkin said, "and not taking a chance on passing all of the water through existing bypass tubes that may crumble under the pressure if forced into full-time action after the hydropower intakes go dry. An even bigger problem, a trickling river through Grand Canyon, awaits if Powell drops below those bypasses, which draw reservoir water from more than 240 feet above river level. I think there will be a lot more discussion in coming years on how to re-engineer the dam," Balkin said. Some environmentalists hope to force that issue. The Center for Biological Diversity argues that the government is legally bound to consider building alternative water conveyances below the existing bypasses. For one thing, the group says, Grand Canyon's signature native fish, the humpback chub, is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. "Relying on the existing bypass tubes would be unsafe," Taylor McKinnon, the group's Southwest director, said in an email. "Reclamation needs to modify Glen Canyon Dam to move more water downstream, and it needs to do so in a way that helps the Grand Canyon's endangered fish instead of begging their extinction," McKinnon said. "How to do that will require careful analysis that should have begun a decade ago." A reclamation official disputes the notion that the four steel bypass tubes, known to the agency as the River Outlet Works, would be unsafe if pressed into action to handle all water deliveries past the dam. It is true that past releases caused some cavitation, a phenomenon in which fluctuating water pressure can cause air bubbles to collapse and chip away at the pipe's coating, said Katrina Grants, the agency's deputy director for the Upper Colorado region and a former lead hydrologist at the dam. But crews have since relined the pipes, and the agency has studied ways to slow releases to minimize damage. "These release limitations on the River Outlet Works are not expected to significantly impact Reclamation's ability to provide water to the lower basin," Grant said. "And Glen Canyon Dam can be safely operated within these limitations." Nonetheless, she compared the bypass tubes to a spare tire, a tool to get past a crisis, but not ideal for perpetual use. "They offer only four outlets compared with the 12 available when the turbines are wet, and they must occasionally alternate shutting down for inspection." Like her colleague Pullen, Grant said the priority for now is protecting the dam and its generating capacity. "We've invested a whole bunch of money," she said, "invested a whole bunch in this infrastructure. And it's important that we protect that infrastructure and those investments that America has made." To Balkin and others rejoicing in the resurgence of a once-buried Glen Canyon ecosystem, it feels like time to change priorities. Keeping Lake Powell full enough to generate power is just setting up Lake Mead for the same problems farther downstream, he said. I call it robbing Mead to pay Powell, Balkin said. A prayer for Grand Canyon. Fully draining Powell presents some legal complications, according to Wegner, the former reclamation scientist who studied the reservoir environment before and after it filled. One of the stated purposes for building the dam was to fulfill interstate compact obligations. Without the reservoir, water allocated to the upper basin but not used there would flow to the lower basin where it would be free for the taking. With it, at least until now, the upper basin has been able to store enough water during wet years to meet its obligations to the lower basin during dry years. Still, Wegner said, it's no longer clear that Glen Canyon Dam is up to the task that the government envisioned 70 years ago when President Dwight Eisenhower signed an act of Congress to impound the river there. At that point in time, it made sense to them, Wegner said. Does it make sense today with the loss of the resources and the challenges we face now with a diminishing water supply? It probably would have been better to have the water in one place, Lake Mead, rather than two large reservoirs that are evaporating large sums of water each and every summer. Grand Canyon National Park officials were praying for something much more modest than fill Mead first when they addressed the guides at their March training sessions. Rob Billerbeck, the park's science chief, said more water in Lake Powell would make it easier to plan flows for environmental enhancements. Like the guides themselves, park officials hoped for a flood from the bypass tubes to rebuild badly eroded beaches, a wish that, as Pullen would announce weeks later, would go unfulfilled at least for another season. Pullen has had to wrestle with other competing interests, states, tribes, utilities, the environment, recreation, and more, and all during previously unimaginable aridification. Billerbeck acknowledged it and the tough choices before the regional director and the other dam managers. If anyone had told him how many giant planning processes he would have to do in record time and how many decisions would have to be made in a year like this, I don't think he would have taken the job, Billerbeck said. Then he led the crowd in what he called a shared prayer. I just want to remind folks that our Grand Canyon Protection Act is just something for you all to remember, he said before loosely quoting from that law. Please repeat after me. The Secretary shall operate Glen Canyon Dam, blah blah blah, so as to protect, mitigate adverse effects, and to improve the values for which Grand Canyon National Park and Glen Canyon National Recreation Area were established, including but not limited to natural and cultural resources in this area. He ended the prayer there, without quoting the law's next clause. Subject to and consistent with the water storage and delivery functions of Glen Canyon Dam pursuant to the Colorado River Compact, the Upper Colorado River Basin Compact, and other laws relating to the allocation of the Colorado River. He didn't need to read that part aloud. Everyone sitting in that warehouse already knew there was tough sledding ahead. And that article was entitled, A Shrinking Supply, and that was by Brandon Loomis. We're almost 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 23rd, 2026. We're going to move on now to Valley and State News. This next article is entitled, Arizona's Basis Charter Schools Dominate Rankings from U.S. News and World Report. This is by Alexandra Hartle. Arizona no longer has the nation's top-ranked public high school, according to a new report from the U.S. News and World Report. But Basis Charter Schools continued to dominate national rankings, placing 11 campuses among the country's 100 best public schools. Basis Schools also took three spots on the list of the top five charter schools in the country and three of the list of top five STEM high schools in the country. Out of the top 10 best public schools in the country, Arizona failed to make the cut, with the first Arizona school coming in at number 15. but 13 Arizona schools made the list of the top 100 for best public schools in the country. In 2024, 12 schools made the top 100, while 11 schools made it in 2025. Charter schools are tuition-free and operate independently of traditional public school districts, meaning they have more flexibility in the operation of the school. They still adhere to some regulations that apply to traditional public schools, such as being prohibited from charging tuition or being affiliated with a religion. The Arizona schools that made the cut in 2026 were number 15, Basis Oro Valley, number 16, Basis Goodyear, number 29, Basis Prescott, number 38, Basis Chandler, number 42, Basis Mesa, number 50, University High School Tucson, number 51, Basis Scottsdale, number 52, Basis Flagstaff, number 58, Basis Tucson North, number 61, Basis Ahwatukee, number 62, Basis Peoria, number 74, Basis Phoenix, number 79, Gilbert Classical Academy High School. Despite Basis schools performing well, Arizona lost its two-year hold on the top spot. Basis Peoria was ranked first in 2024, while Basis Tucson North was ranked first in 2025 for the best public high school in the country. Arizona performed well in the rankings for the best charter schools and best STEM high schools. Basis Oro Valley was ranked second for best charter school in the country, while Basis Goodyear was ranked third and Basis Prescott was ranked fifth, respectively. In the category for best STEM high schools, Basis Ahwatukee came in second, while Basis Chandler came in third and Basis Scottsdale came in fifth. Lamont Jones, managing editor of U.S. News, said Basis charter schools were preparing their students well for college and other types of post-secondary education. They do a great job at educating students for life after high school, whatever those students want to do, Jones said. Basis was founded in Tucson, but has schools globally. In 2018, the Charter School Network in Arizona attracted controversy when records revealed it had obtained about $5 million in parent donations to subsidize teacher salaries. At the time, it was reported that the schools were asking parents for $1,500 per child. Overall, Arizona was ranked number 28 among states. That category was based on which states have the largest proportion of eligible high schools in the top 25% of rankings. Last year, Arizona was ranked number 32. Massachusetts was ranked number 1 both years. How were the rankings determined? Jones said the schools were evaluated on a range of variables based on data provided by the states. Each variable was then weighted differently. Only four states, Colorado, Maine, New York, and Vermont, declined to allow U.S. News to use advanced placement from College Board. College readiness, 30%. This indicator took into consideration the number of students who took at least one advanced placement or international baccalaureate test by the end of their senior year, as well as the number of students who took and earned a qualifying score, an AP score of 3 or higher, or an IB score of 4 or higher, or at least one AP or IB test by the end of their senior year. College curriculum breadth, 10%. This indicator took into consideration the percentage of 12th graders who took and earned qualifying scores on multiple AP or IB exams. State assessment proficiency, 20%. This indicator took into consideration student proficiency in math, reading, and science on the statewide assessment. State assessment performance, 20%. This indicator compared state assessment scores with what U.S. News predicted for a school with its demographic characteristics in its state. U.S. News said that schools performing best on this indicator are those whose assessment scores far exceeded U.S. News's modeled expectations. Underserved student performance, 10%. This indicator evaluated Black, Hispanic, and low-income student scores on state assessments compared to the average for non-underserved students among schools in the same state. graduation rate 10%. This indicator looked at the four-year graduation rates among students who entered ninth grade during the 2020 to 2021 school year. And that article is entitled, Arizona's Basis Charter Schools Dominate Rankings from U.S. News and World Report. That was by Alexandra Hartle. Our next article from Valley and State News is entitled, New Websites Let You Track Flock Camera Use Locations. This is by Elena Santa Cruz. Public backlash against Flock Safety's license plate reader cameras is fueling a new effort to map the technology's reach, with volunteers creating databases that track searches and camera locations nationwide. Criticism continues to intensify against the company and its cameras, which automatically take photos and collect data on passing vehicles. For law enforcement, it's a criminal investigative tool. Many others say the technology feels like mass surveillance that was implemented without public input. In just the past 2 weeks in Arizona, law enforcement agencies across the valley reported that police officers were suspected of misusing the Flock system. Agencies were canceling their contracts, and others were rethinking their policies regarding Flock. Opposition has not been limited to Arizona, and various websites exist where people can check whether they've been looked up in Flock's database, where Flock cameras are, and how people can try to avoid them on trips. In response to rising pushback, Flock officials announced on August 13th that they were making systemic changes to address community concerns. These include limiting the company's data retention, requiring law enforcement users to adopt Flock's audit tool, and making it mandatory for law enforcement to attach a search to an actual criminal investigation. The latter two must be adopted by the end of 2026. It's unclear if the changes will do anything to quell concerns, as people around the nation have said they want to see the cameras gone. Flock's position on the websites that share database queries and camera locations is unknown. A spokesperson for the company did not respond to a request for comment. Here's what to know about the Flock data residents across the nation have compiled. Has my vehicle been looked up in Flock? Want to know if a law enforcement official or Flock user has run your plate through Flock's system? Check out Have I Been Flocked? Data on the website was obtained from audit logs that track searches made in Flock's system, according to the website. It was compiled through public records requests and is updated regularly. Searches on the website are not saved, according to the website. The data set is incomplete. Records requests could take months to years to fulfill. Requests to certain agencies may not have been made yet, but the data received has been heavily redacted, and few agencies make the audit logs available to the public, according to the website. The website does not include data on whether a Flock ALPR camera has captured a vehicle. HaveIBeenFlocked.com is funded through donations. Alternative News Weekly Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit, sponsors the website. Where are Flock cameras? DFlock, a crowdsourcing project, has a map showing where license plate reader cameras are across the nation. Each dot on the map indicates a camera. On August 17th, the Midwest and East Coast appeared to have a higher density of cameras than the western half of the U.S. There are cameras across Arizona, according to the website. Metro Phoenix and the Tucson area appeared to have more cameras than the rest of the state. The map mainly shows the locations of Flock cameras, but it also includes other camera brands. DFlock also shows the growth of license plate reader cameras since January 2024 and provides a comparative analysis of where cameras exist and how law enforcement agencies disclose and share license plate reader data. The website is dflock.org. There is a downloadable application. Can I avoid Flock cameras? Flock Hopper is another website that shows where cameras are. But it has another feature. It tells users how many times their vehicle might be captured on a drive and suggests the best alternative for avoiding license plate reader cameras. To test a route, users enter their destination and select how far away in feet they want to be from the cameras. The website then provides the difference between the most direct route and the privacy route in miles and cameras. The website is don'tgetflock.com/maps. There is a downloadable application. And that article is entitled New Websites Let You Track Flock Camera Use Locations. That was by Elena Santa Cruz. Our next article is entitled More Than 100 Sonoran Desert Tortoises Up for Adoption. This is by Helen Rummel. Arizonans searching for a unique desert companion could soon get the chance, with more than 100 tortoises up for adoption through the Arizona Game and Fish Department. Each year, the department connects Arizonans with dozens of adoptable Sonoran desert tortoises. An increase in people surrendering the animal to the department has meant more tortoises ranging in age and size are in need of a new home. Captive tortoises are not able to be returned to the wild because they can carry respiratory diseases that threaten the wild populations. Captive desert tortoises are often the result of illegal captive breeding. The species is protected in Arizona, meaning the tortoises cannot be taken out of the state. While tortoises have specific needs, local experts encourage those interested to reach out. It's rewarding to hear stories from those who have adopted a captive tortoise and made them part of the family, because they're a unique alternative to traditional family pets, Tegan Wolf, desert tortoise adoption specialist for the Arizona Game and Fish Department, said. They offer many of the same life lessons to children, and they can provide just as much companionship and personality as a dog or cat. A person looking to adopt a tortoise also should be aware of their long lifespan. A desert tortoise can live for anywhere between 80 to 100 years. Families can own a tortoise for multiple generations, depending on how old they are when adopted. Those interested in adopting a tortoise are required to show they have a burrow for them to create a home in. In the wild, tortoises burrow into the ground to escape the desert heat. Tortoises are herbivores and should have accessible leafy greens, grass, and flowers to graze on throughout the day. Arizonans looking to adopt a tortoise can apply on the Arizona Game and Fish Department's website. That article is entitled More Than 100 Sonoran Desert Tortoises Up for Adoption. That was by Helen Rummel. Our next article is entitled Deadly Phoenix Road Rage Shooting Sends Teen to Prison. This is by Helen Rummel. A teenager was sentenced to 14 years in prison after shooting and killing a man in a Phoenix road rage incident last August. The victim, Porfiria Medina, was driving a scooter near a Phoenix intersection when he nearly collided with a car in which 16-year-old Henry Gonzalez was a passenger. Medina, 45, then followed the car to an intersection near 7th Street and Buckeye Road. He approached the passenger seat when Gonzalez rolled down the window and shot him in the chest. The vehicle fled the scene without calling 911 or reporting the accident to police. Video surveillance, license plate readers, and cell phone location data directed law enforcement to Gonzalez, who was 15 years old at the time. Gonzalez admitted in interviews with investigators that he had illegally bought the handgun several days before the shooting, knowing it was illegal for minors to possess. He said he sold the gun after the shooting out of fear he would use it again. A brief confrontation on the road ended with a man dead and a teenager facing years in prison, Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell said in a statement. One reckless decision changed two families forever. Gonzalez pleaded guilty to one count of manslaughter, which is a Class 2 felony. And that article is entitled Deadly Phoenix Road Rage Shooting Sends Teen to Prison. That was by Helen Rummel. We're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We've got two front page articles. One is on Canada and Mark Carney, and the other one is on Iran. Our first article is entitled Carney vows to hit back with retaliatory levies. The subtitle is, says duties will target U.S. Steel Electronics. This is by Promeet Mukherjee and Bhargav Acharya. Prime Minister Mark Carney said on August 22nd that Canada would impose tariffs starting September 8th on imports of U.S. steel, electronics, and other products in retaliation for President Donald Trump's 50% tariffs that took effect at midnight. After days of intense negotiations, the two countries did not reach a trade deal late August 21st, worsening a delicate relationship between the longtime trade partners and allies and complicating the future of the Continental Free Trade Pact known as the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Trump's new tariffs hit sectors including wine, furniture, dairy products, cement, clothing, fishing rods, and hockey equipment, and cover some $20 billion of Canadian exports to the United States. These duties do not exempt Canadian products under the USMCA, which has shielded most Canadian exports to the United States in the last 18 months. Canada will match Washington's new tariffs dollar for dollar in order to protect Canadian workers, farmers, families, and businesses, Carney told a news conference. You're at war when you get attacked. We got attacked, Carney said when asked a question about whether Canada was engaged in a trade war. Carney is one of the few global leaders to retaliate against U.S. tariffs and has pledged to forge new trade and military alliances, despite Canada's dependence on the United States for nearly 70% of its exports. Canada will impose tariffs on U.S. steel, dairy, appliances, agricultural equipment, pulp and paper, and electronics, along with some products the United States previously targeted in Canada, Carney said from Ottawa's Parliament building. The government will release details on its response in the coming days, he said. We cannot accept what they have offered, and we will not give what they have asked, Carney said. Trump had earlier expressed hope that a deal with Canada could happen on August 21st. But Carney said the U.S. administration's last-minute demands halted progress. In recent days, the U.S. proposed new terms that were uneconomic, unfair, and undermined the net benefits to Canada, calling into question the reliability of any deal, he said, adding these demands included curtailing Canada's ability to forge new trade deals. Carney said Canada would announce support measures this coming week for industries impacted by the new U.S. duties, adding these measures could last years. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer told Fox News on August 22nd that no new talks are planned with Canada. We are moving forward with measures that respond to Canadian retaliation, Greer said. They've always had the best deal, and they still would have had an even better deal, but they didn't want that. The White House, the U.S. Commerce Secretary's office, and the U.S. Trade Representative's office did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The new U.S. tariffs cover around 5% of Canada's exports to the United States. They could expose some vulnerable industries such as softwood lumber and wine to severe damage and lead to job losses and business closures, trade experts have said. We will be mobilizing our network of businesses in all regions and all sectors to brace for impact and make the best of a bad situation, said Candace Lang, CEO of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. Ontario Premier Doug Ford, one of the most vocal opponents of U.S. tariffs, supported Carney's decision to retaliate. I'm glad he didn't sign that deal because it was a bad deal. It was a bad deal for Ontario. It was a bad deal for the auto sector, the steel sector, and manufacturing sector, Ford told reporters August 22nd. One of the main sticking points was the treatment of larger vehicles. Three sources said Canada wanted favorable tariff terms proposed for light-duty vehicles to extend to medium and heavy-duty trucks, something the United States resisted. Carney said the U.S. position would have excluded Canadian-made models, including Ford's F-350, F-450, and F-550 trucks and General Motors' Silverado, making Canadian production less competitive. There were also U.S. proposals that affected Canadian culture, language, and sovereignty, Carney said without elaborating. Carney was elected last year on a promise to be a tough negotiator with Trump and remains broadly popular. Polls show most Canadians oppose making any concessions to the United States. Canadians must stand united to defend our country against these unfair attacks on our jobs and businesses, Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the official opposition Conservative Party, said in a statement. And that article was entitled, Carney Vows to Hit Back with Retaliatory Levies. That was by Promeet Mukherjee and Bhargav Acharya. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled, Trump Has Options to Pressure Iran's Economy. The subtitle is, New Measures by U.S. May Be Announced Soon. This is by Andrea Shalal. President Donald Trump has vowed to hit Iran hard economically after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that Washington would impose measures on Tehran that have never been seen as soon as this coming week. Bessent is due to hold a news conference on August 24th. The United States, UN, and EU have applied sanctions, implemented trade embargoes, and frozen assets since the late 1970s over Iran's nuclear program, human rights violations, and support for militant groups. Since the Iran war began in February, Washington has levied additional maritime, energy, and financial sanctions and started a naval blockade. Data from the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control shows the agency has imposed sanctions on more than 1,000 people, vessels, and aircraft since Trump began his second term. Recent measures have targeted Iran's shadow oil fleet, shipping insurers, entities and people enabling Iran's acquisition of weapons and digital exchanges, freezing an estimated $500 billion in Iran-linked cryptocurrency. Iran has denounced U.S. plans to announce new sanctions that could put further strain on the Islamic Republic's economy. Oil shipments are at a virtual standstill in the Strait of Hormuz, with Tehran threatening to strike any unauthorized oil tankers that try to transit the vital waterway, and Iran's economy is already under immense pressure from sanctions. Experts say the Trump administration also can try these options. Teapot refiners. Chinese independent refineries known as teapots account for a quarter of Chinese refinery capacity. They operate with narrow and sometimes negative profit margins. China buys more than 80% of Iran's shipped oil, according to 2025 data from analytics firm Kepler. Independent refiners absorb much of this trade, exposing them to so-called secondary measures that penalize entities helping a primary sanctions target. Past U.S. sanctions have deterred larger independent refiners from buying Iranian oil. But the independent refineries are somewhat immune since they have little exposure to the U.S. financial system, sanctions experts say. Sanctions on Chinese banks. The Office of Foreign Assets Control has imposed secondary sanctions on smaller China and Hong Kong-based entities accused of processing billions of dollars in Iranian oil and helping to fund weapons procurement. The Treasury Department has warned two larger Chinese banks they could face secondary sanctions if Iranian funds were found moving through their systems, but has stopped short of designating them. Hitting those two banks, which U.S. officials have not publicly identified, or imposing other sanctions could have a chilling effect on bigger financial institutions, sanctions experts said, although they warned it could also trigger retaliatory actions by Beijing. Trump administration officials have sought to play down tensions between Washington and Beijing ahead of an expected meeting between Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping later this year. They worry that China could curtail exports of critical minerals that are essential to advanced technology production at a time when the United States and Western allies are still trying to develop their own supplies. Whack-a-mole. the United States could continue targeting Iranian individuals and entities, as well as others in China and the Gulf, that are helping Tehran evade sanctions to collect revenues for its war effort. The Treasury Department recently issued sanctions against firms that are springing up to facilitate Iran's trading of oil revenue for imports. But such measures amount to a whack-a-mole approach that has not altered Iran's behavior, said Brett Erickson, managing principal of Obsidian Risk Advisors, noting that Tehran simply creates new entities to replace them. Miad Maliki, a sanctions expert with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, said Besant was likely signaling a sharpened enforcement push against oil shippers, purchasers, and currency exchangers who help Iran pay for its imports. Further aviation sanctions were also possible, aimed at degrading Iran's ability to move trade now that the United States has blockaded shipping via the Strait of Hormuz, he added. Land blockade. Some U.S. and Israeli officials have floated the prospect of a land blockade, which would require assistance from Iran's neighbors, Iraq, Turkey, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. The Trump administration has varying degrees of closeness with all those countries except Afghanistan, but that border is mountainous and extremely difficult to patrol anyway. Trump may have leverage over Pakistan, which recently sought a $10 billion currency swap line from the Treasury, and Turkey, which is seeking to rejoin the U.S. F-35 warplane program. A land blockade could increase pressure on the Iranian people by halting their imports of food, energy, and textiles, but experts say such a move would be difficult to execute and might not result in protests or internal pressure. Secondary tariffs. Trump has repeatedly threatened tariffs on goods from countries that do business with Iran, although the Supreme Court struck down the legal basis for such taxes. And that is all the time that we have for with this article entitled, Trump Has Options to Pressure Iran's Economy. That was by Andrea Shalal. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 23rd, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.